Today is March the 2nd, 2022. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is www.pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. We are nearing now, almost at the beginning of a third year, of a home lockdown, which was begun back on March the 19th, 2020. I'm eagerly looking forward to returning into the studio for live calls from you, the listening audience. In the meantime, however, you can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. David Boggs, an electrical engineer and computer scientist who helped create Ethernet, the computer networking technology that connects PCs to printers, other devices, and the Internet in offices and homes, died on February the 19th in Palo Alto, California. He was 71 years of age, and the cause was heart failure. In the spring of 1973, Mr. Boggs began an internship at Xerox PARC. One afternoon in the basement of the lab, he noticed another researcher tinkering with a long strand of cable. The researcher, another new hire named Bob Metcalf, was exploring ways of sending information to and from the lab's new computer, the Alto. Bob Metcalf was trying to send electrical pulses down the cable, and he was struggling to make it work, so David Boggs offered to help. Over the next 2 years, they designed the first version of Ethernet. Many of the key technologies that would be developed over the next 2 decades as part of the Alto project would come to define the modern computer, including the mouse, the graphical user interface, the word processor, and the laser printer, as well as Ethernet. Ethernet was eventually codified into an industry standard. It became the dominant protocol for building networks in corporate offices. It would eventually be used in homes too, and today's wireless networks borrow pieces from the Ethernet protocol and often connect to Ethernet hardware. At Xerox PARC, as Bob Metcalf and David Boggs pieced together a blueprint for Ethernet technology, it was challenged by several other technologies in the early 1980s and 1990s. Bob Metcalf said, when David Boggs took to the stage at a California computing conference at the San Jose Convention Center to discuss the future of networking, a rival technologist questioned the mathematical theory behind Ethernet, telling David Boggs that it would never work with large numbers of machines. David Boggs' response was, "Well, it just seems Ethernet does not work in theory, only in practice." Restrictions on high-tech exports to Russia. Last Thursday, the United States, United Kingdom, and European Union imposed multiple new restrictions on exports to Russia in response to its war against Ukraine. When it comes to high-tech items, the restrictions are quite sweeping and are designed to curtail development of Russia's defense, industrial base, military, and intelligence sectors. In addition to military and intelligence capabilities, multiple adjacent industries, including those that serve civilians, will be affected. Meanwhile, exports of civil equipment will either remain unrestricted or regulations will be less severe. The new rules imposed by the U.S. Commerce Department require companies to obtain a license from the U.S. government to export semiconductors, computers, telecommunications, information security equipment, lasers, sensors, navigation equipment, avionics, marine equipment, and aircraft components to Russia. All companies that use U.S. technologies or components to produce the said items are required to apply for an export license to the U.S. government, including Taiwan-based Semiconductor, which produces multiple chips for Russian entities. These applications will be reviewed with a presumption of denial. Taiwan Semiconductor already said that it would comply with the new export control rules, which would leave Russia without chips that could potentially be used by its military, law enforcing, and intelligence agencies. European chip designers and producers, such as Bosch, NXP, and X-Fab, also said they would comply with the new export regulations. Taiwan Semiconductor said in a published statement, "Taiwan Semiconductor complies with all applicable laws and regulations and is fully committed to complying with the new export control rules announced. The company also has a rigorous export control system in place, including a robust assessment and review process to ensure export control restrictions are followed." Similar restrictions were applied to China-based Huawei a couple of years ago, and needless to say, they were devastating to the company. Without chips made by Taiwan Semiconductor or Intel, Huawei's share on the smartphone, server, and PC markets collapsed. Taiwan Semiconductor produces chips for multiple companies that ship them to Russia, including AMD, Intel, and NVIDIA. It is unclear whether these three companies will be able to obtain a license to ship their products to Russia at this point. It is also unknown whether companies like Dell, HP, or Lenovo that ship their PCs and servers to Russia entities will need to apply for a license since these devices contain materials on the restricted list. Another peculiarity with these restrictions is that they do not cause any immediate problems for Russia and its government. The country will most likely have enough stockpiled hardware to keep its military, law enforcing, and intelligence sectors operating. But eventually they will be hurting, but maybe not for months. It is not an immediate body blow. The new export restriction rules include categories that will be reviewed on a case-by-case basis, which means that a significant part of export license applications will be granted. The categories reviewed on a case-by-case basis are related to humanitarian needs, safety of flight, maritime safety, government space cooperation, civil telecommunication infrastructure, government-to-government activities, and to support limited operations of partner country companies in Russia. The United States will not restrict consumer communication devices, software updates to civil end users, consumer encryption technologies, and even items for use by the news media, if they are not destined to government end users and Russian state-owned enterprises. Essentially, this means that Russians will still be able to buy Apple iPhones, keep using Apple Mac OS and Microsoft Windows, not to mention acquire medical equipment and even news production equipment. While similar restrictions severely impacted Huawei, they are not going to harm Russia significantly. The restrictions will not harm Russia immediately as state-owned entities and commercial companies tend to stockpile components and materials they need. Furthermore, there are export license categories that will be reviewed on a case-by-case basis, not with a presumption of denial, so there will be high-tech entities in Russia that will continue to operate as usual. Export of things like smartphones, cameras, microphones, and other tools like that will remain largely unregulated, so an average Russian will not feel any consequences caused by restrictions. It is also not completely clear how the new export rules affect shipments of ARM-based consumer electronics to Russia. ARM is a U.S.-based company, and semiconductor exports to Russia were tightened by the U.K. government, and whether PC makers will need to obtain an export license to ship their products to Russia. Is there a fallout with the Russian invasion into the Ukraine with the International Space Station? On Thursday, new sanctions were announced against Russia that would, among other effects, degrade their aerospace industry, including their space program. Dmitry Rogozin, the director of Russia's space agency, responded with a series of tweets about the International Space Station. "Do you want to destroy our cooperation on the ISS? If you block cooperation with us, who will save the ISS from an uncontrolled deorbit and a fall on the United States or Europe? The ISS doesn't fly over Russia, so the risks are all yours." Russia is one of the nations that operate the ISS and has two of its own cosmonauts on board. Although the station's orbit path falls mostly outside of Russia, the ISS does pass over a small part of its southern border. The International Space Station is not about to come down, though, and Russia can't press a button and drop it out of its orbit 260 miles above Earth. Rogozin was referring to the fact that the space station currently relies on Russian propulsion systems to maintain its altitude in orbit and was apparently threatening to withdraw those services. It'd be a shame if anything were to happen to it. Rogozin's American counterpart, the NASA administrator, Bill Nelson, did not respond directly to the Russians. The agency said in a statement, "NASA continues working with all our international partners, including Roscosmos, the Russian space agency, for the ongoing safe operations of the International Space Station." For decades, officials in both countries have stuck to the same lines about the value of collaboration in space. Projects such as the ISS are bastions of international cooperation. In 2014, when the U.S. and other countries issued punitive measures against Russia for its takeover of Crimea, questions about the welfare of the ISS effort came up. Then, as now, there were assurances from NASA that the two nations' work on the ISS would be just fine. NASA said Thursday night that a new USS ban on technology exports to Russia wouldn't extend to ISS operations. What happens next is less certain, however. It is uncertain how long space agencies such as NASA and the European Space Agency, which includes 22 nations, can keep their working relationships with Russia untarnished by the fallout. The idea that earthly matters doesn't impact space travel is now not a certainty. NASA has already been disentangling itself from its ties to Russia, but several international space missions this year currently rely on Russian partnership, and both American and European officials will have to re-examine those efforts and decide whether they've reached that point. Americans and Russians have worked together in space since the 1970s, not long after the United States landed men on the moon and its space race with the Soviet Union drew to a close. In the summer of 1975, an Apollo module and a Soyuz capsule docked together in orbit, the first international astronaut mission in history and a show of détente between the superpowers. Astronauts and cosmonauts continued to meet in space in the 1990s, taking turns spending time in the American space shuttles and Mir, the Russian space station. The U.S. eventually asked Russia to join its efforts alongside the European and Japanese space agencies to build a brand new space station, and together they started assembling the ISS piece by piece in orbit in 1998. The ISS is divided into American and Russian segments, and it relies on both sides to function. While NASA supplies electricity to the entire station, Roscosmos provides the spacecraft that attach to the ISS and periodically nudge the whole thing into higher orbit, the capabilities to which Rogozin referred in his provocative post. These spacecraft are supposed to help decommission the ISS when that time comes by pushing it into a careful plunge through Earth's atmosphere that ends over the ocean. If Russia were to suddenly jump ship, NASA and its other partners on the ISS could come up with an emergency solution before the station was in danger or became a danger itself. NASA is already exploring other propulsion options. An American spacecraft currently docked to the ISS is scheduled to test some orbit-boosting moves in April. The U.S. is less tangled up with Russia in the space realm than it was the last time Russia went after one of its neighbors. In 2014, with American space shuttles in retirement, the Soyuz was the only ride to the ISS, giving Russia leverage. When the U.S. banned cooperation with the Russian on space activities outside the ISS, instructing companies to stop using Russian rocket engines, Rogozin joked that NASA could use a trampoline to reach the station. Today, however, SpaceX, Elon Musk's company provides transportation for NASA astronauts and their European colleagues, where before the U.S. paid Russia millions of dollars for a seat. This is the discomfort as Russia presses ahead in Ukraine. So what does that mean for the two European satellites scheduled to be launched on a Russian vehicle from French territory in April? Russia is already backing away. Rogozin said yesterday that in response to sanctions from the European Union, Roscosmos would stop working with its European partners at the spaceport in French Guiana and recall Russian personnel stationed there. And what of Europe's next mission to Mars? A rover is expected to be launched from Russia's spaceport, Kazakhstan, in September, and if it doesn't leave in a certain window of time, it will have to wait 2 years before getting another shot at reaching the red planet. Meanwhile, the ISS is still chugging along. In fact, a Russian spaceship gave the station its latest gentle boost after Rogozin's menacing warnings. The U.S. intends to keep operations going through 2030. Russia has signaled a potential earlier exit than that, saying it would assemble its own home in orbit. The story of the ISS, established as a symbol of global cooperation, could end on a sour note. Ukraine's role in the global semiconductor production. Ukraine is home to half of the world's neon gas, which is critical for manufacturing semiconductor chips. Ukraine is home to a little-known company called Cryolin, which plays a big role in the global production of semiconductors. Cryolin makes neon gas, a substance used to etch patterns into computer chips. It supplies companies in Europe, Japan, Korea, China, and Taiwan. But most of its neon is shipped to the United States. Any disruption to Cryolin's supply could be felt around the world. Cryolin's production of neon and other gases ground to a halt on last week as the invasion began by Russia. There was no damage to the facility as of Monday. Russian aggression in Ukraine is making the industry nervous that these shortages could be intensified. Last week, U.S. and Japanese governments were scrambling to find alternative sources of this obscure gas. Ukraine is just one of a series of choke points in the global semiconductor industry. Ukraine's neon industry was built to take advantage of the gases produced as byproducts of Russian steel manufacturing. What happens in Russia is that those steel companies that have the facility to capture the gas will bottle it and sell it as a crude. Then Cryolin has to purify it and take out the other gases. When Russia annexed Crimea in 2014, the world's chip makers were even more dependent on Ukraine because the country supplied around 70% of the neon gas. There were delays in shipments, and because of border crossing issues and the raw materials needed to make neon were also in short supply. Burned by that experience, the chip industry scrambled to diversify its supply. A company called Cymer, which is owned by the Dutch chip giant ASML and makes the lasers used to draw patterns on advanced semiconductor chips, tried to reduce its consumption of neon. Chip makers are concerned about recent escalation of neon prices and supply continuity. If access to Russian crude does become an issue, Cryolin has enough supplies to keep production going until the end of March. If that runs out, there are Ukrainian crude producers that Cryolin can turn to if the plants are still there as alternatives. However, the worry will be about getting neon out of the country. Borders right now are very overloaded as people, civilians, are trying to evacuate. ASML sources less than 20% of the neon it uses in its factories from Russia or Ukraine. They are investigating alternative sources in the event of a supply disruption from Ukraine and Russia. There are concerns that the U.S. is even more vulnerable. What's coming into the United States from Russia and Ukraine could be as much as 80-90% of all neon imports in the United States. But sourcing neon from elsewhere will not be easy. Any disruption in Ukraine will hit chip makers at a time when the industry is already under intense pressure from post-pandemic demand. The drive behind increased production is so strong that it is causing strain in the supply chain everywhere, even without a war. There is no excess supply of this kind of gas in the Western world. The world's largest semiconductor manufacturer, Taiwan Semiconductor, is among the companies suspending sales to Russia because of their invasion into Ukraine. The global computer chip industry, including the giant Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, has begun halting sales to Russia in the wake of U.S. sanctions aimed at punishing Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. They would cut off more than half of Russia's high-tech imports and kneecap the country's ability to diversify its economy and support its military. The ban, which is also being enacted by major U.S. allies, is designed to choke off deliveries to defense and other high-tech buyers in the aerospace and maritime technology sectors, but not to block deliveries of consumer electronics. Taiwan Semiconductor has suspended all sales to Russia and to third parties known to supply products to Russia while it sorts through the sanctions rules to ensure it's fully compliant. Taiwan Semiconductor said it is fully committed to complying with the new export control of the rules that were announced. Global Foundries, the chip manufacturer based in Malta, New York, said it also has begun complying with the rules. The company has a system to review and block any prohibited sales to Russia. The company's head of global government affairs and trade added that the size of the company's sales to Russia buyers is not material. Intel, based in Santa Clara, California, said it complies with all applicable export regulations and sanctions, including the new Russia-focused export controls. Russia is vulnerable to the export ban because it doesn't produce consumer electronic chips in large quantities. In particular, it doesn't make the highest-end semiconductor needed for advanced computing, an area dominated by Taiwan, South Korea, the United States, Europe, and Japan. Taiwan Semiconductor participation in the sanctions is particularly damaging because the company is the world's largest manufacturer of chips, including the most advanced. Among the chips, Taiwan Semiconductor is no longer manufacturing and shipping Elbrus-branded semiconductors, that's Elbrus, that are designed in Russia. Russia's military and security services use Elbrus chips in some computing applications. The Russian government has also been encouraging large domestic companies and banks to use the Elbrus chips in their computers because the components are designed in Russia. The Semiconductor Industry Association, a trade group representing big chip makers, said its members are fully committed to complying with the new rules in response to the deeply disturbing events unfolding in Ukraine. While the impact of the new rules to Russia could be significant, Russia is not a significant direct consumer of semiconductors, and they only account for less than 0.1% of global chip purchases, according to the World Semiconductor Trade Statistics Organization. The United States and other Western nations have long regulated sales to Russia of chips and other electronic components specifically designed for military use. Any such sales already required a government license to proceed. The new rules largely block the sale of dual-use chips, which have both military and commercial applications, to non-military users in Russia, including those in high-tech industries. In a novel move that the United States has used only once before against China's Huawei, it is also requiring companies worldwide to abide by the rules and block such sales to Russia if they use U.S. manufacturing equipment or software to produce chips. Most chip factories around the world use software or equipment designed in the United States. That approach is called the Foreign Direct Product Rule. Russia's access to cutting-edge U.S. and partner country technology will halt. Its defense industrial base and military and intelligence services will not be able to acquire most Western-made products. First, some background information. The acronym ARM stands for Acorn Risk Machine, which was founded in 1983. ARM now is used as an acronym for Advanced Risk Machine. RISC is a machine architecture of a reduced instruction set computer, which is a type of microprocessor architecture that utilizes a small, highly optimized set of instructions in iPhone and Android cell phones. The business model for the company ARM is the charging of a royalty rate, a small percentage of the total selling price of the RISC chip from CPU manufacturers. ARM Limited, which is owned by SoftBank, entered into a long-term joint agreement with China, Unicom, in February 26 of 2019 to form a wholly owned subsidiary under ARM Limited called ARM China. To get into the China market, many companies are forced to set up agreements in which the operating company in China has majority control. In this case, ARM Limited SoftBank had 47% control. China Unicom has 51%. On September 13, 2020, NVIDIA announced plans to acquire ARM Limited from SoftBank, and pending regulatory approval for a value of $40 billion in stock and cash. On February 8th, which is just a few weeks ago this month, the NVIDIA ARM deal fell through after heightened regulatory scrutiny. To bypass regulatory review, ARM Limited is now considering an IPO, which might raise as much as $80 billion. However, complicating the deal, during the process of the NVIDIA ARM merger, it had been impacted by a rogue CEO in ARM China. Alan Wu, chief executive and chairman of ARM China, asserts that the company he heads may go public in either Shanghai or Hong Kong sometime in 2026 or later. He expects ARM Limited, which is set to list at New York Stock Exchange early next year, to support the ARM China's IPO. Keep in mind that ARM Limited cannot make its initial public offering IPO without properly disclosing its financial results and sources of revenue to regulators, which includes money it gets from ARM China, which refuses to open its books. The comment made by Wu endangers ARM Limited IPO as ARM China seeks independence from its parent. ARM China is a joint venture between ARM Limited, currently owned by SoftBank, and a consortium of China-based investment funds, including China Investment Corporation. Because Wu possesses the corporate seals, he cannot be fired from ARM Limited, which is why he is known as a rogue CEO. ARM China says that the intellectual property licensing and royalty fees it generates accounts for about 25% of ARM Limited's revenue. Meanwhile, it also asserts that it had developed a portfolio of technologies that allow it to continue operations without its parent company, because in this case, ARM China has a majority control. Wu said ARM China has already developed a capability to continue its operation separately from ARM in the UK. Wu also expressed his disappointment with ARM's decision in May of 2019 to cease business with Huawei Technologies, Inc., following Washington's decision to add the Shenzhen-based telecommunications equipment maker to the U.S. trade blacklist. ARM's unresolved legal dispute with its Chinese unit, which contributes about 25% to the British firm's annual licensing revenue, casts a shadow over the prospects of a smooth IPO. Regardless of that public listing, ARM chief financial officer told a media briefing early in February that problems involving the Chinese joint venture must be resolved. This looks like an intellectual property theft. It appears that ARM China will attempt to use previously transferred assets to bootstrap its own transformation into an independent company, of course, with the intellectual property of the RISC architecture. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. What is software volume licensing?
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, technology, the workplace, and how it all impacts you. In this case, I want to go back to something that was originally in the business world. It was something called software volume licensing. It still exists. It's still with us, but it impacts you in some very interesting ways. I'm going to give you one example that is very valuable. I love this, and it's great. But simply put, licensing like this, software volume licensing, is basically you going down to Costco and buying not one package of macaroni and cheese, but buying 50 packages of macaroni and cheese at a very steep discount. Now, it doesn't have to be macaroni and cheese. That was the thing that popped into my head just now. What's happening there is instead of selling you one package for $2, they're selling you 50 packages for $20. You win in the end. You seriously win in the end. And this has been done in the business world since, I would say as far back as I can remember. I've been professionally in the IT field for over 30 years. And I remember arguing, not really arguing, but counting up and going through and going, we've got 38 computers. So we're going to buy 38 licenses at half the cost of buying these individually, one at a time. This has been around for quite a while. It makes it easier and more affordable to run software on all of these different computers within that single licensing organization, if you will. So whatever it is. So this occurs in small businesses, and they get their pricing for the software that goes on the servers, that goes on the desktops, that whether we're talking about Windows or we're talking about Microsoft Office or whatever it is. And yes, they come through and they do audits, whether you're a small company, a medium company, or a large company, that big business. But the amount that we think that somebody would pay, $100 for a license of Windows, well, no, at a certain point, it actually starts getting dialed back quite a bit. How many different servers do you have? You know, if you've got X amount of servers, you can buy our server software not for $5,000, but for $2,000. And it goes on. And this applies even in the world of education. But here's something that's even more exciting. You might want to check with your IT department, because many different software licensing packages include, yes, for the employer's computers, but as a special bonus for the employee computers. I remember that we worked out a licensing agreement for one of the companies I was working at, and I was the one who actually worked this out. We had a particular piece of software, and that particular piece of software was the antivirus. And if we purchased X amount, and we were right there, we were within five. I think we had like 95 systems, and if we purchased 100 licenses, we would be able to actually not only outfit that antivirus on our 95 computers, but we would also be able to allow all of our employees, up to the 100 of the license, to have a license for themselves for their home computers. And it was a negligible cost. I went to my boss. I said, look, we can offer this as a perk. We can buy the 95 licenses. If we buy the 100 licenses for $12 more or whatever it was something stupid, we could then go to all of our employees and give them a benefit for working for the company. He said, yes, $12. At one point, I offered to pay for it out of my pocket. I said, this is just ridiculous. We shouldn't even be arguing this. And he actually agreed with me. Now, What's one of the greatest areas? It's something that I've been very happy to have for quite a while now, and that's Microsoft 365. We're talking about the Office 365, and it includes a number of different packages of Word and Excel and PowerPoint and Outlook and so forth and so on and so forth and so on. And this can be used across your desktop, your laptop, your tablet, your phone. Now, if you buy this for one license, you buy one license, it's $70 per year. That's okay. And, you know, if you've got anybody in your family, if you have a spouse, it already pays for itself for you to go to the volume licensing plan because it actually goes to $99 per year. Now, for $99 per year, you get not the 1 terabyte per person, not the one license, but you get 6 of them. This goes for, I mean, if you are, you know, husband and wife and you have 4 kids, and this allows each of those people to put it on up to 5 systems. This is an amazing deal, and that is really underscoring what software volume licensing is about. It's a matter of if you're going to pay just a little bit more, you're going to reap the rewards for this. So, yes, I have Office on my Chromebook, on my desktop, on my laptop, on my Mac, on my iPhone, and so forth. It's well worth it. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. It takes 3 months and 700 steps to produce a computer chip. The huge expense of building a semiconductor factory and the months-long process needed to make a chip means global demand is far outstripping supply. Countries have been lavishing subsidies and perks on semiconductor manufacturers as the global chip war heats up. There are hundreds of companies that design computer chips, but fewer than 24 globally that manufacture them in large quantities, leaving those factories under huge pressure. Many of the biggest facilities are in Taiwan, which now produces 20% of the world's semiconductors and over 90% of the highest tech chips, according to a report commissioned by the Semiconductor Industry Association. Asia as a whole produces about 3/4 of global semiconductors, while the United States manufactures about 13%. At semiconductor foundries, employees don elaborate protective wear at the start of each shift to prevent stray lint or hair from marring the wafers. Even a speck of dust can ruin the painstaking process for producing the chips. Semiconductor factories are filled with static hum of $10+ billion worth of machinery and the warm glow of yellow light, which protects the light-sensitive wafers from damage. The 12-inch silicon discs look like shiny, smooth mirrors when they arrive at the factory. 3 months later, they are covered with intricate etchings forming billions of transistors. The microscopic switches that control electric currents and allow the chip to perform tasks. There are about 700 processing steps along the way, through which dozens of layers of patterns are printed and etch on top of each other, following designs provided by each chip customer. Think about making a cake. In this case, it's like going to be a 60 to 75 layer cake, and that cake is built over approximately 2.5 to 3 months. To create each layer, the wafer is coated with a light-sensitive chemical. Then a high-tech printer known as a lithography machine projects the same tiny pattern over and over across the wafer as if it were stamping the same pattern on every square of a checkerboard, with each square representing a future chip. Afterwards, an etching machine engraves those patterns into the wafer, and more chemicals are deposited and baked onto the surface. This process repeats over and over as different patterns are laid on top of each other to create dozens of layers of transistors. Then the layers are connected to each other via copper wires to allow signals and power to travel throughout the chip. The most crucial and expensive pieces of equipment in the factory are the lithography machines that print the intricate designs on the wafers. Each machine costs roughly $100 million to $340 million for the higher tech chips. To boost output means building new factories. Chip makers have started construction on 29 new fabs worldwide, according to Semi and Industry Association. China and Taiwan will build more than half of these, 8 each, followed by 6 in the United States, 3 in Europe and the Middle East, and 2 each in Japan and Korea. The United States manufactured more than a third of the world's chips in the early 1990s, but production shifted to Asia as chip companies sought cheaper labor and as Taiwan, South Korea, and China began heavily subsidizing chip manufacturing. U.S. officials and lawmakers are now eager to rebuild domestic chip production with the help of federal subsidies. As chips become more central to weapon systems and to the economy overall, relying too much on Asia undermines national security. For now, U.S. manufacturers will have a hard time catching the low cost and sophistication of Asian rivals. Taiwan and the Koreans are the best in the world when it comes to price and quality. The most advanced manufacturer, Taiwan Semiconductor, and South Korea Samsung, both have announced plans to build new factories in the United States. Chip companies have emphasized the need for better STEM education and worker training to prepare the semiconductor manufacturing workforce. There aren't a lot of colleges that offer curriculums surrounding semiconductor manufacturing. Semiconductor companies look for employees with degrees in material science, chemistry, or engineering, and many are offering apprenticeship that provide 2 years on-the-job training to employees without a degree and works with community colleges to help design chip-related curriculums. Last week, Intel unveiled new details of the processor that will power the Aurora supercomputer, which is designed to become one of the first U.S.-based high-performance computers to pierce the exaflop barrier, a billion-billion high-precision floating-point calculations per second. Ponte Vecchio is the name of the project, and it packs in a lot of silicon to power the Aurora supercomputer. The processor, called Ponte Vecchio, is a package that combines multiple compute, cache, networking, and memory silicon tiles, or chiplets. Each of the tiles in the package is made using different process technologies, in a stark example of a trend called heterogeneous integration. Ponte Vecchio is a masterclass in 3D integration. Each Ponte Vecchio processor is two mirror image sets of chiplets tied together using Intel's 2D integration technology. Intel expects the Zeta Scale era of supercomputers to kick off sometime around 2028. Ponte Vecchio is meant to consume 600 watts, so making sure heat could be extracted from the 3D stack was always a high priority. Intel engineers used tiles that had no other function than to draw heat away from the active chiplets in the design. Intel also coated the top of the entire chiplet agglomeration in heat-conducting metal, despite the various parts having different heights, atop that is a soldered base thermal interface material, and their acronym that they use is STIM, and an integrated heat spreader. The different tiles each have different operating temperature limits on the liquid cooling and air cooling. This solution manages to keep them on range. Each Ponte Vecchio system is capable of more than 45 trillion 32-bit floating point operations per second, otherwise known as teraflops. Four each system fits together in a complete compute system. These will be combined for a total exceeding 54,000 Ponte Vecchios to form Aurora, a machine targeting 2 exaflops. It's taken 14 years to go from first petaflop supercomputers in 2008, capable of 1 million billion calculations per second, to exaflops today, a 1,000-fold increase in performance. Gee, if that ever gets on a consumer level, It's going to be faster than human reaction. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston with Technology Chatter. Subaru accident leads to new car technology.
Marty Winston joins me now here on Computer Talk Radio. So, Marty, what was it? A few weeks ago, three weeks ago, you were talking about your little mishap. Speaking of driving, your mishap with a...
It wasn't a mishap. I got rear-ended at 45 miles an hour by a kid in a Jeep. I mean, is that a mishap?
Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, fair enough.
I wasn't hurt. I mean, really, those rear-end things with the extra seatbelt clasp where it immediately jerks you back and keeps you there.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And that... I suffered zero. I was out and walking around. The guy in the Jeep behind me got punched in the face by his airbags, but he ended up walking around a little bit later.
Sure. So quick question, 45 miles an hour, airbag went off. Did he have a broken nose?
He didn't seem to.
Okay.
But I can tell you his spirit was rather broken.
Oh, I bet, yeah. So 50-50 is what I heard. For 45 miles an hour, 50-50 with the airbag. So you were in a Subaru Crosstrek?
X3 Crosstrek, yeah. 2014 nice. Okay. X3 Crosstrek.
Oh, and, okay. Nice.
My son totaled an Outback years ago and walked away from it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm never buying anything that isn't a Subaru. Build some loyalty. So I ordered a 2022 Forester, but it isn't here yet. In the meantime, I've been renting, some fairly new cars and a Jeep go ahead.
So we're a tech show. We talk about computers and technology. My big question for you, my next question is, we're talking 8 years of advancement in technology in a number of different directions.
And the hardest thing for me to get used to, was not having to reach for the key fob to get in the car or start it.
Yes.
It does make me wonder what I'm going to have to do when that battery dies. But for the moment, it's
fine. Yeah.
And they're chunky, aren't they? Those little key fobs. It used to be so thin, and now it's like you can use it for a flashlight and a wood drill and other things.
Yeah, beat the burglar over the head with it, kind of thing. Ah. Yeah. Some of those key fobs get pretty big. I've got a keyless entry key fob like that. 2014. Is the year for my car. Keyless ignition and the whole bit. But now I've got a GPS that's just ancient, and I don't know who invented this.
I hate the Subaru wanted to charge me like $2,000 a year to update the maps.
$2,000. Okay. That's
maybe I'm wrong, but I think that's what the quote was. And I thought, well, first of all, why can't I just take this SD card and rewrite it? But I wasn't able to pull that off. And then I just put a little mount on the dashboard and stuck my phone up there and let Google Maps take me everywhere. At least sure, Google Maps knew that there was a slowdown, you know?
Yeah. So now on the new one. On the new one,
I've got Android Auto. I don't have to put my car up, my phone up there anymore. Mm-hmm. The car will show me all that stuff. It has more USB ports than my desk, and my desk probably has 40. it's not really more. It's just more useful.
Sure,
It's the one that's unoccupied that you can never find. it's also got some driver assist stuff, the blind spot warnings in the side view mirrors and the thing where when you're backing up, you don't just see what's behind you, but you get warnings of somebody crossing behind you. And when you get too close to the car ahead of you, they hit you on the head with a hammer or something and make you stop. Quiz time.
Okay.
Listeners, you can play too. In the automotive industry, what were the very first two anti-collision measures?
Anti-collision measures?
Answer?
Mm-hmm.
Brakes and a horn.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Yes. Yeah.
Early vehicles didn't have either one.
Oh, wow.
Laws were passed requiring brakes because cars would, in that era, just kind of glide to a stop. And laws were also passed to make the car stop at every crossroad, every intersection, get out, honk the horn, make sure no one was coming, get back in, and putt-putt off.
Okay. Well, it's a lot better than having that person running in front of your car with the little flag to warn everybody.
Yeah, I know it's so hard for those cars to keep up with those people.
Going back a few years.
Yeah, a lot of leather in those.
So what is the tech that you're looking forward to the most? We've got just a minute left.
It's a safety tech. It's knowing what people are in the wrong place at the wrong time. And if they're coming at me, I want the option to get away. And if they're not coming at me, I may want to have the option to get ahead of them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's that kind of thing. And outside of that, do I want a Tesla? No, I'd rather not blow up or have it drive over other people. It's one of those things that I didn't like.
So if it catches on fire, I mean, the fire will go out in 4 or 5 weeks.
I don't have to pay a Tesla price to get a car that'll catch fire.
I have no idea. Is Subaru's got an electric vehicle now too?
Oh, right? They have a hybrid, and it gets almost exactly the same mileage as their normal gas engine because they're very good at economical gas engines. So very few people buy them.
Okay. Fair enough. So there you go. There's Marty's experience there. And hopefully he won't have another experience like that for a very, very long time.
Thank you, Ben. And thank you, Marty. The upcoming 46th Annual Original Personal Computer Festival, otherwise known as TCF, the original and oldest computer festival in the world, is March the 19th, 2022. It is a virtual festival via Zoom, and the website is tcf-nj.org. The time for the festival is from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and the keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, Disrupting Environmental Climate Changing Using Technology, and he is the co-author of the UN World Climate Change Report. He is from the Rutgers Institute for Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. Saturday, March the 19th, 2022. The time is from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. And the website is tcf-nj.org. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Since most club meetings are online, you are most welcome to attend any of the online meetings. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on disruptions at scale through innovation. Thursday, March the 3rd. Meeting time starts at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their monthly meetings on March the 4th. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi, and the website is acgnj.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, March the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The restaurant no longer offers a free Wi-Fi, and a vax ID and mask is required. And the phone number is 347-278-7320 to confirm that the meeting is still on. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, March the 10th. Meeting time starts at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, March the 11th. The starting time for the meeting is 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.